On October 2nd, 1970, a plane carrying the Wichita State football team to play a game against Utah State crashed into a mountainside in Colorado. 14 first stringers were killed. Members of the coaching staff, fans, and supporters of the Shocker program also lost their lives. There were only 9 survivors. In the time that has passed since the crash, there have been memorials and countless other remembrances. And while most people are no longer grieving, many still remember, each in their own way. My name is Abigail Wilson. My uncle, Bob Renner, was the quarterback for the Shockers that year. He survived the crash. He's my mom's oldest brother, and I've always been interested in his story, but it's been years since he talked about it, even to our family. I knew he was in the crash and that it was a life-changing experience, but I never knew to what extent. And sometimes I wish I didn't know as much as I do now. Some of my uncle's teammates and their families helped me to put together the pieces of this story. Today, along with a dozen or so people, I'm hiking to the crash site on Mount Jalisse in Colorado, just before the Eisenhower Tunnel.
And the problem is, it's almost as difficult going down because you need to slip, so always just lean backwards.
The group includes Rick Stevens, who survived the crash, his children and grandchildren, and John Yeros, a member of the 1970 Shocker football team. I've brought along my mom, who says she wanted to come because her brother, my uncle, has distanced himself from the memory of this place and these people.
Johnny, I'm Bob Renner's sister.
You're kidding me.
No, so I'm doing this.
I didn't know that. Where is he?
He's in Missouri.
How you doing?
Good.
Good. So how far up are we right now, do you think?
About halfway, I think.
The hike is steep, and the path really doesn't exist to the untrained eye.
Take 10 more steps!
Plane crash survivor Rick Stevens leads the way, using a long hiking stick he's carved to help steady himself.
So you said it's harder this time for you?
Well, it is. My right ankle is having some issues, and I don't have a lot of strength pushing off on it, but I'll make it.
Rick takes a few minutes to catch his breath, and we keep hiking. We're up high enough that looking through the woods across the valley, the tree line is visible on the surrounding mountains. The trail curves to the right, and there's a sudden, unnatural clearing in the pine trees.
Oh, my God.
They took the engines and other parts of the airplane so that they could inspect them and look at them. This stuff is just like the parts of the wings. And
After a hurricane or an earthquake, people rebuild. Shattered windows are repaired. New walls replace crumbled ones. The tragedy is relocated to the depths of our minds. Death is replaced with new life, and with time, it all just slips from immediate memory. The Oklahoma City bombing, the Greensburg tornado, even 9/11.
See it up there? Landing gear and landing gear.
But this place on this mountainside has never been reclaimed by anything but stray vines and mountain grasses. Pieces of the plane sit exactly where they fell 45 years ago.
And right here in between this was where the fuselage was.
Maybe that's because this clearing is so high up on this mountain, invisible to those who drive by on Interstate 70, thousands of feet below. 31 people lost their lives because of what happened here. Most were young men in their late teens and early 20s, a team of boys with big hopes for a new football season. 11 made it out of the plane, but 2 of them died later from their injuries, leaving 8 Wichita State football players and 1 crew member as survivors. There's a metal buckle here from a suitcase, a tarnished pull tab from a pop-top can.
You know, it's all just a bunch of pieces. How did anybody get out of what's left up here?
The wreckage is serene and disturbing. Standing next to the twisted, corroded aluminum, it feels like I found the carcass of an injured animal that crawled away to die in solitude. Today, when there's a plane crash, the wreckage is collected and the entire crash is recreated somewhere else to be studied and analyzed. When this plane went down, it was determined to be pilot error, and only a few major pieces were taken, leaving the rest to settle into the side of Mount Trelease. And in the 45 years that have passed, the entire world seems to have moved on. And so has Wichita State.
I'm doing a documentary about the Wichita State plane crash. Do you know anything about the crash?
Not too much about it. I just know that a lot of students died during that time.
Do you know where the memorial on campus is? Have you ever been there?
No, I haven't.
Do you know about the Wichita State plane crash?
Not much. Only that it was football players. About it.
I'm not aware of it, no.
No, you don't know it even happened? Okay, what about you?
I don't know anything about the crash, but I did see the memorial, but I guess I've never paid attention to it.
Okay, and what year are you?
I'm a freshman. Okay.
Are you a freshman? Okay, where are you guys from?
Here.
From Wichita?
Yeah. Okay.
There were two planes carrying the team that day. The aircrafts were named Gold and Black, in reference to Wichita State University's colors. Rick Stevens wore number 72 on his jersey. He was 22 years old and a 6'2", 220-pound senior. Rick was on the gold plane.
I think it was October 2nd. We had left Wichita State. Beautiful day, October. And went out to the airport and got on two planes. The first team was the gold plane, and the black plane was the second team. And we headed for Utah State.
Number 23, John Yeros, was a running back. He took a seat on the black plane that day, in the very front.
Front two seats on each side faced the back, and row two faced the front. So four of you could kind of sit, and we'd play cards, and you could just talk to each other, so they're just like rows down the plane. So we were just yakking, and they fed us a box lunch. I remember eating this white box lunch that they gave us that had a sandwich in it.
They took off and headed west. Both planes stopped for a minor repair and to refuel in Denver. From there, they would continue to Logan Airport in northern Utah. The players were directed to their separate planes, the gold plane for Rick Stevens, the black for John Yeros.
Someone heard their pilot tell our pilot that he was going to take the scenic route. And, you know, we didn't know. We got on our planes, and we had no idea that they went directly over I-70.
Rick Stevens.
And we took off, and our plane headed directly towards the mountains. The other plane headed north up to Wyoming. And we found out later that the reason, because the elevation in Wyoming is about 7,000 feet, and here it's over 14. And our pilots apparently were not fully aware of what they were getting into and the capacity of the airplane. As we were flying along over I-70, I noticed sitting there that the plane was not gaining altitude to keep above the foothills. Now, that seemed odd to me. I didn't really know why, but so I got up. The fellows around me were sleeping, Jack Vetter and Mal Kimmel, and I got up and went into the cockpit. And I could see then and there that they had topographical maps out and were concerned about where we were going to go. They were very concerned, not panicked. At one point, I heard one of the pilots say, "Well, can we make that one?" The other one responded, "No, we can't." And as I turned to go back into the cabin area, I could feel the plane bank. And then it began to clip trees. I could feel that sudden impact as it clipped the trees. I fell to the floor, and I'm pretty sure I was knocked unconscious at that point.
The plane was flying too low to clear the steep mountain pass. When the crash took place, smoke was visible from the roadway, where construction workers were building what is now the Eisenhower Tunnel. The men abandoned their work and headed up the side of the mountain to find the plane and try to help.
Next thing I know, I was waking up outside the airplane, spitting dirt and pieces of gravel and some of my teeth out, and you're in a situation like that, it's almost impossible to rationalize it in your mind. That's what has happened. I mean, it's just so surreal.
Rick had been launched through the front of the plane on impact, along with the co-pilot, who also lived through the crash. The others had either climbed or been pulled through a small hole near the back of the aircraft. Reports from the investigation say that most of the passengers survived the initial impact, but were trapped under debris in the plane and unable to escape.
at that point, I was passing in and out of consciousness. And some fellas were working on the tunnel came over, and by this time, the others had left the airplane. And the ones, there were some that got out late, Tom Reeves and Johnny Taylor, and they were there when the plane caught on fire. These fellows with the construction crew carried me down this way, and as you can imagine, carrying a 220-pound load in this atmosphere is pretty difficult. They stopped to rest, and I remember looking up and watching the plane explode at that point. And once again, it just magnified the how unreal it was. Vic Bell, one of the, I believe he was a foreman, had a pair of coveralls on, and in order to carry me, he took those off, and they laid me on them and carried me down that way. As you can imagine, that would be difficult. And it was a Friday. He got paid that day, and he had his paycheck in those coveralls. The coveralls ended up in Denver with me, and he had to drive drive up to Denver and get that. I don't know that I've ever adequately thanked Vic and those other individuals who I do not know who they were, but they carried me down. I my leg was broken and my hip was dislocated. I was not able to. I couldn't walk at all.
The black plane was still in the air, heading for Utah. John Euros.
You know, these were not fast planes, so we were up near for another couple 3 hours still getting to Logan, and we land. And they had radioed ahead to our pilot and said, keep everybody on the plane. And so he called our assistant head coach up, Bob Seaman, to the front of the plane. And Bob said, everybody just stay here. He left. And Coach Seaman came back and said, took a roll. So he took roll to see everybody that was there. And then he left again. And then he came back and he gave us the news that the plane went down. He said, plane went down by Loveland, Colorado, and there's at least 25 survivors. Now, that's the first stuff coming out. And then they got us off the plane and put us on a bus. And we were just in shock. We just didn't, you know, we didn't know what to think. And they took us to our hotel, which was this old motor lodge. You know, it's not like a nice Marriott now. It's this motor lodge, and it was, you know, it was two stories, and, you know, it had a balcony with a railing on it, so you went into your room from the balcony outside, and it didn't have enough phone lines to get all of us to get phone. You know, there were no cell phones, and there were only a certain number of lines leaving the hotel, and all of us needed to start calling somebody.
As word of the crash spread, a mountain search and rescue organization was called in. John Putt was a young and eager member of the Alpine Rescue Team.
On the day of the crash, we were brought up by the Clear Creek County Sheriff to search around the site, the crash site, to make sure nobody had been overlooked. So we got up here about 3 or 4 hours after the crash and searched around the site while everything was still pretty much burning and smoldering and the sun was going down.
And you were pretty young, is that correct?
Yes, I was 12 years old.
And were you prepared for that?
No, it was a day of contrast, of thinking we were going to prove ourselves because it was the first rescue mission we'd ever gone on. And realizing that the day unfolded into an unimaginable tragedy. The survivors were down, and it was much more of a surgical scene that night. The trees to our right were basically cut at a 45-degree angle as the plane came to a rest. And then this was just a black hole of molten metal and burning trees and passengers.
The team's ticket manager was named Floyd Farmer. He often traveled with the Shockers and was on the Gold Plane. Floyd was killed in the crash. His son Eric is now a dentist with an office in Wichita. But on October 2nd, 1970, he had just turned 6 years old.
Then I remember coming home from school. When I got home from school, The TV wasn't on, which was kind of strange. And the family across the street asked me to go to a fun night at Joyland. So went there. In retrospect, I think people were acting kind of funny that night. Maybe I could be embellishing that, but in retrospect, looking back on it, it seemed like I was kind of isolated, maybe on purpose. And I remember getting home. I don't remember what time it was, but cars in the front, card tables out, candy dishes on the table in the house full of people. Then I think Mom took me back and said there was an accident and my dad had died. At six, I don't know that you have a really good grasp on dead and forever. I really had no experience with death up until that point, so I didn't. I think I asked her, does that mean I'll never see him again? Because that was my frame of reference at the time, and I think, I'm pretty sure she said, yeah.
Anyone who's ever been on a sports team or in a club knows the bonds you form with teammates. Being forced to leave those people behind, knowing they weren't going to survive, isn't something I think I could handle. Standing at the crash site with my mom was harder than I ever expected it would be. I never knew the scars it left on her life, the unanswered questions, the magnitude of what it must have been like to wonder what happened immediately following the crash, waiting for the news of who survived and who didn't. I try to put myself in my mom's place, and it makes me sick to my stomach.
I didn't think it'd be so emotional for me.
Has your brother ever come up?
He went, and I've asked him so many times. He just really doesn't even talk about it.
I understand now why my uncle never talked to us about the crash. But I know he remembers. Memory is like grief. We all process things in our own way. For some people, that means you block it out completely. For others, you revisit it daily, yearly, whenever. But you have to keep going. For the remaining Wichita State football team, including running back John Yeros, part of moving on meant continuing the football season in honor of their teammates. He says the Shockers lost all of their equipment, which had been on the Gold Plain.
So that picture you always see of the helmet, see the picture of the helmet and the shoe and it's all burnt? That was taken right here, and this was all of our equipment. So we had to wait to get all new helmets, all new pads, new everything. And so we, you know, we were probably, I can't remember how long, but it's probably a week. We probably only had a week of practice before we went to Little Rock, Arkansas. They petitioned the NCAA to allow our freshmen to play because back then they couldn't play on the varsity. And we went to funerals. So we started going to funerals. That we could get to. They made sure that there was two players and a coach at every funeral. So if you were a close roommate, my roommate is John Duren, so I went to his funeral in Oklahoma City.
How many funerals did you go to?
Probably half a dozen.
And in what, in 2 weeks time span?
Within a week, yeah. So from Friday, the accident. Remember, we had a game. This was October 2nd. We played University of Arkansas on October 24th. So 3 weeks and a day later, we had already buried everybody and started practice.
Yeros says he doesn't remember counselors being made available to the team. So they relied on each other, football, and whatever they could pull up from inside in order to keep going.
Back then, there wasn't like today. You know, you just picked up and moved on. Like counseling was each other. You know, we didn't know what else to do. We were just kids, and we were there to all on scholarship. And, you know, we knew. I think the thing that was the most important was that we believed that those that passed would have wanted us to continue. I think that that was the overwhelming feeling. And so our grief was all wrapped up in getting back and playing, and it really wasn't about us. It was kind of about them, and it was just what we did, you know. So we went on, and we played at Arkansas, got beat badly, lost the next six games of the season, and then, you know, kept going. So
And being up here now, what's this like? How many times have you been here before?
A dozen, okay. Maybe. It's hallowed ground. You know, it's just hard sometimes. I always tell myself I'm not going to cry when I come up here.
A memorial service for the crash is held every year at Wichita State University. Survivor Rick Stevens is always there, determined to remember those he lost. Rick has hiked to the crash site and has ridden his bike from Wichita to Silver Plume, Colorado, nearly 500 miles, to raise money for the scholarship fund that benefits the descendants of the crash victims. He says coming to this place never gets any easier.
You can't, I can't help but recall how fortunate, how, you know, just the miracle that I did get up and that I was not in a position to be trapped. And the good life that I've had, I've been reasonably healthy all my life. I have a wonderful wife and kids and grandkids, and you think about the fact that those lives, those people who were denied that, they were denied that, and I have a very difficult time of ever seeing how that is planned. That was in the fate of some executed plan by whatever existence there is that would cause such a thing.
Rick couldn't help anyone trapped inside the plane that day. He was too badly injured. He knows that. But I can't help but think it still bothers him.
It's almost impossible to imagine those individuals that were able to free themselves from the traps of the broken furniture in the airplane and just the sheer terror of what had happened. They had to make a horrible decision. Can I help anyone get out of this? Can I put my life at risk? There would have been no way that anyone could have. It was a terrible. I didn't see the inside of it for your Uncle Bob and all the others that had to make that decision of, you know, it's, can I help anybody get out? And no, I can't. I know Randy Jackson told me one time that he stopped and tried to help Jack Vedder, and Jack said, "One, Randy, you can't help me." And that's, they had to live with that. That's tough. That's very tough.
Do you wish you would have been able to go in?
No, not at all. I wouldn't, no, I don't. I couldn't have helped anybody.
At age 6, when he lost his father, Floyd, the team's ticket manager, there was no way Eric Farmer could have fully understood what happened when the plane crashed.
I think that gave me a pretty early grasp on forever. But, you know, in talking to some of the other kids that lost parents over the years, a lot of us that I've talked to have said, you know, and still, this many years later, we still expect them maybe to walk up the front porch like they were lost in the mountains for 70. How long has it been, Abigail? I don't know if it's strange or what's the word I want to use, but that we all kind of felt that way, that it maybe really didn't happen, or somebody was okay and they'd been lost and they'd grown a beard and they're living in a mountain man or a mountain woman in the mountains and finally got their memory back type of a thing. But that, I guess that seems to be common.
Eric says that people around him didn't want to talk about the crash. They wanted to get back to normal. And the tragedy didn't fit into their view of what normal was.
We can be terribly critical of that in, you know, 2015, but it was a different time and a different place. The way we thought about things was tremendously different. And I don't think that's anybody's fault. I just think that was, you know, the era that it happened. Certainly, that's how we acted. Chin up.
For Eric, though, one thing has stuck with him since losing his dad. He has chosen not to let the loss define his life.
You know, at some point, I got tired of being the kid whose dad died in the airplane crash. I wanted to be more than that.
At the crash site on the side of Mount Trelease, the group I hiked up with gathers together. Small yellow flags are handed out. Each flag bears the name of a friend, family member, or teammate who died in the crash.
You can take a couple, take three. We're just going to just put them wherever you'd like to, and we'll read off the name.
Joni Knoll chooses two flags. Her hike today is in honor of her brother, Mike, who was on the plane that made it safely to Utah 45 years ago. But he passed away from cancer in 2009.
And so I brought some of his ashes up here because I wanted him to be up in this sacred place with the people that he loved so dearly. His roommate, Don Christian, and his sweet mate, Tommy Owen, and his roommate the first year he went up there, Randy Keesaw, a lot of the boys that were like brothers to him, lost their lives up here on this mountain. And I know that that day, although my brother was safely on the other plane, a part of him died up on this mountain too.
She finds a flat area near the wreckage and sticks the yellow flags in the ground. Joni carefully spreads her brother's ashes near the flags.
It was something that I needed to do and have wanted to do for a long time, and just emotionally didn't know whether I was ready to do it or not, and still didn't know as I started up this mountain today whether I was emotionally ready to do it or not. But I knew I would have a lot of special guardian angels watching my trek up the mountain, and so I felt like it was time.
For some people, the time to come to this place may never happen. And that's okay. But what do we do when time moves on, but the past remains? When it's not just a memory, but is still physically here, right where I'm standing? Looking down, my mom finds a piece of rock with metal seared into its side from the heat of the crash or maybe the explosion that followed. The circular piece of corroded aluminum is forever molded to the stone, similar to how the events of October 2nd, 1970 have become part of these people's lives. It's still here, even after all this time. For KMUW News, I'm Abigail Wilson.